Indian language. And I'd like to say this to you, that when I was young, the other kids used to make fun of me a lot because I used to spend my time with the older people. And I'm really glad I did, because I learned a lot of things. I learned the rituals, I learned the ceremonies, and I was able, as Norman told you over this Wednesday, to perform a ceremony for a friend of mine who had passed away recently. And it's rather sad that I had to do all of this, because there are more than 900 people who belong to that tribe. And there was only one man who could offer a prayer in that language, and he was ill with pneumonia. And so I did everything. Now, if the people in this particular tribe had not always made fun of this chieftain who died, perhaps they would have been able to have learned the language of the Wampanoag Indians of Massachusetts. But you see, what happened was they used to ridicule him, and so he just passed away with all of this knowledge, leaving only one person in this entire tribe who can speak Indian, but who refuses to do so because her brother spoke Indian and the people used to ridicule him. So he made her promise him when he was dying never to teach the people, never to teach his own people. And so there's really no one left now who can teach these people a language. And this is what happens when people don't have understanding or don't try to hold on to something important. These words that I'd like to say to you in Catawba language, you hear as part of a commercial, and you hear it every day on the radio and on television. And these are the words in Catawba. Minin Wijo Pax Yuxu. Now I'd like you to listen to that again. Minin Wijo Pax Yuxu. Now try that with me. Minin Wijo Pax Yuxu. Try it again. Minin Wijo Pax Yuxu. Can you do it without me? Yes, and that's a very familiar commercial. That's Warm Pop Sausages, Mom. There are dances where the dancer does his best to imitate the movements of an animal, or the sounds of an animal. And one of the Catawba dances is called the horse dance. The horse dance, the dancer tries to kick up and tries to cause his head and to sound like a horse when the horse is neighing. So I'd like to show a few of you this dance. I just had an idea. I thought if I just went, the step is very easy. I thought if I went through this once or twice, that it's possible that we could have three or four who would like to come up and try to do the dance with me. But watch me first. This is a horse dance, and these are the movements. Thank you. See, the important thing is to sound like horses. Can you do that? Let's hear it. History books, you've seen stories of them in the movies and occasionally on television. But there are a number of Indians who have been important, who many people know nothing about. Sometimes people living only within a short distance of these people know very little about what a particular person could or could do in life. I'd like to show you a photo of an Indian lady, a Wampanoag Indian from Mashpee, Massachusetts, whose name was Rhoda Sturgis. And the reason that this lady was quite important was for the fact that she could identify 200 different types of herbs that the Indians used for illnesses, for remedies. She was that I told you who was able to speak the language and whose sister has now made him a promise never to teach it to anyone. This was also taken in Mashpee, Massachusetts. This photo was taken in 1921 by Dr. Frank Speck from the University of Pennsylvania. There, the Wampanoag Indians were very good basket makers, but through the years, people lost interest. And in 1933, this man, Chief Evan Kwepish, taught a group of 20 women how to make basket skin, so that even though he has passed on, there are still some women up there today who know how to make baskets out of ash splints. This man had a rather sad passing. He had been to a baked bean supper at the Indian church in Mashpee, and on his way home, he was hit by someone who was intoxicated in a car and left to die along the side of the road. But he was a very, very fine man. New York State, the Hudson River flows up. It's near the village of Stockbridge, New York. There were a group called the Mohegan Indians. Not Mohegan like you know. Not M-O-H-E-G-A-N, but M-A-H-I-C-A-N. These people moved from New York State. Most of them in the 1830s moved out to the state of Wisconsin. But there were a few people who remained behind, and one of these was this lady, Harriet Quinney. In the town of Mashpee, and let me tell you where Mashpee is. Mashpee is near the town of Hyannis and Falmouth. It's up on Cape Cod in Massachusetts. And there was an Indian from this tribe, his name was Solomon Attaquin. He built a hotel, and it became very famous because men like Daniel Webster, Grover Cleveland, Franklin Pierce, and numbers of other presidents used to go up there to fish. And this is the granddaughter of Solomon Attaquin. These are a couple of the children. Well, now they're both grown-ups and they have families of their own, but these are once school children in the village of Mashpee, Massachusetts. Now, they have a very fine school there now. It's made out of brick. It's called the Samuel G. Davis School. Well, they used to have a plain two-story wooden building. And one day, this gentleman from Boston was walking through the village of Mashpee. And then a big stiff wind came along and blew his hat off. So a little Indian boy went down the road, picked up his hat, brought it back to him, and brushed the dust off with his hand and gave it to the gentleman. And the man offered him a dime. And the boy said, no, sir, he said, I was taught never to take money for common courtesies. So the man asked him, he said, what's your name? And the boy said, my name is Irving Oakley. So when he went back to Boston, he changed his will. And he left enough money in his will to build a new school for the people in the town of Mashpee, because he was impressed by the politeness of that little boy. And he also left a sum of money that is given annually to the politest children in the village, so that every year school children up here win awards for politeness. So I think the highest award is $30 or $40. But it just shows just what a little politeness can do. Just through a little boy, they have a new school. This is a member of the Wampanoag tribe also, whose name was Tamsin Weeks. And she was one of the last speakers of the language. And she lived on an island which perhaps many of you have visited in the summer. It's called Martha's Vineyard. And over at Martha's Vineyard, there is a village called Gayhead, where these people live today. This gentleman was the most famous Indian guide on Long Island. He's from the Shinnecock tribe near Southampton. His name was Charles Bunn. He could hit anything flying with a shotgun. And his services were required by men all over the United States. He knew the forest and the marsh out there, and he passed away recently. This is a photo of him when he was in his prime. He was 32 years old, and this is a photo of him when he was 86. If you ever go to the Museum of Natural History, now I think they've rearranged it, they will have an exhibit there of a wigwam as used by the Shinnecock Indians of Long Island. And that wigwam was built in 1915 by this gentleman whose name was Wickham Cuffey. The name Wickham, the first name, is just a corruption of the name Wigwam. So if you do see this in the Museum of Natural History, it was made by Wickham Cuffey. This perhaps was just about the most famous Indian in perhaps the last 80 or 90 years in the East, because he did one remarkable thing. He walked from Brooklyn to Montauk Point in one day. And some people said this was not true, that nobody could walk that far in a day. But Ripley, you know, you've read Believe It or Not by Ripley. Ripley makes it a business of being able to prove everything that he says. And he has established the fact that this man walked from Brooklyn to Montauk Point. And that's a distance of 136 miles. He was such a good walker that P.T. Barnum hired him. And he used to walk around the rings in the circus. He would take on anyone, and no one was ever able to catch him. There's another story. His name is Steve Talkhouse. His real name is Stephen Farrell. But they call him Steve Talkhouse because of the fact that, he talked very little. But many people in East Hampton, there are still families in East Hampton today, old people, who remember that Steve used to walk from Montauk Point to East Hampton, used to spend an evening with a family, and then turn in, get up in the morning about 4 o'clock, when the family would get up about 7, he would have the breakfast all ready on the stove, and he would be in Bridgehampton, where he would be cutting an acre of grain. He would cut an acre of grain, and Norman knows that, cradle an acre of grain, finish his work, and be back to Montauk Point before it got dark. Once Mr. Baker from the Amagansett mail coach stopped him. He was walking along the road, and he said to him, "Steve, get in, and I'll give you a ride," because Mr. Baker had a horse and wagon. And Steve's famous words were, "No thanks, I'm in a hurry today, I think I'll walk." You know, by the way, these photos, some of these photos are here in your school, or they can be used for reference. This lady was Pocahontas Farrell, the last member of the Montauk tribe, or the last member of the royal family of the Montauks. And she used to make these brushes, which are very much in demand by housewives on Eastern Long Island, because they would outlast steel wool in cleaning pots and pans. I don't know if you girls have had much experience cleaning pots and pans, but a scrub brush like this, you haven't that old one yet. I'd like to show you how long a scrub brush is. Here's one that was used for 3 years. I mean, it's just about down to the end, but this is how they look in the beginning, and this is how they look after a lot of use. But can you imagine a piece of steel wool lasting 40 years? It's always impossible to have everybody come up here and do something, but there is something that we can all do together, and that is we can learn a song. And I'd like to teach you a song from the Senecas of New York State. You'll notice that I keep saying Seneca. Well, the Seneca, the Cayuga, and the Onondaga, these are the three tribes who have kept the native religion and who have held on to the songs and dances. This song is a social dance, and it sounds like this. I raise my hand first, and everyone answers, "Whee!" And then you repeat behind me. Now let's try that again. Way hot. Way hot. Way hot. Way hot. Way hot. Sounds like this. I say, "We got you a honey," and you answer, "We got you a honey. We got you a honey.
We got you a honey.
We got you a honey.
We got you a honey.
We got you a honey.
We got you a honey.
We got you a honey.
We got you a honey.
We got you a honey.
We got you a honey. I'd say, hold you got way no way. And your answer's, hey no way, hey no way. Hold you got way no way.
Hey no way.
Hold you got way no way. Now, you still answer, hey, no way, when I change, when I say, yo, that's the one that came. You still answer, hey, no way. And we're going to liven the song up a little. In the center, 5 points. That's my favorite spot. Here, 3 points. Here, 1 point. And here, where she manages to get it always, one. This is zero. No score. The object of the game, boys, you stick, the hoop will be tossed to you, and you catch it. You don't throw the stick. Just. Each team we give a name to, we'll call you the little flowers. Boys, we'll call you the little muskrats. Now we're going to let her, just watch her, she'll show you how the game is played. Now, normally we throw it from a much further distance, but she'll miss anyway. Alright, 3 points. So that doesn't happen very often. I watch me throw five. That's a bad throw, but. Alright, girls. Now, see, I try to make you miss by war hooping. So I'm gonna try to make you miss. See. Yeah! more than she did, but it was in the zero area. Indians of Canada. Mi'kmaqs live in Nova Scotia, Prince Edward Island, and New Brunswick. They said that years ago, their creator, who was called Glooskap, when he landed on the shores in what is now Prince Edward Island, that he saw the land was very beautiful. There are no people living in it. So before he made people to live on the land, he wanted to make sure what the reactions of the animals would be. So he went up to the bear, and he said, "Bear, I would like to make people to live in this land. What will you do if you see a man?" And the bear said, "Well, I think they will hunt me for my meat and fur, and I should want to live somewhere where they can't find me." So Glooskap said, "Very well, then your home shall be in the woods, and in the wintertime you will sleep in a cave or in a hollow tree." And so the bear went off. The next animal he saw was a moose. And he said, "You are a moose. What will you do when I make people to live in this land?" And the moose said, "The hunters will want my meat, my fur, and I should want to live where it's far away, where they can't find me easily." And so Glooskap said, "Very well, your home shall be in the deep north woods, and it shall be hard for the hunters to find you there."
And so the moose went off into the woods. There's another animal with a flat tail, Coabi, the beaver. And Glooskap said, "You beaver, what would you do when you see people?" And the beaver said, "Well, now I live on the land, and it would be easy for the hunters to find me, and they would want to take my fur to make clothing." So Glooskap said, "Very well then, you shall live in the water, and you shall make your home out of mud and sticks, and you shall carry the mud on your flat tail." So the beaver splashed into the water, where he's lived ever since. And in those days, Mikoa, the squirrel, was the largest of all animals. And Glooskap went up to the squirrel and said, "You squirrel, what will you do when I make people to live in this land?" The squirrel said, "Well, I'll uproot trees and I'll throw them at the people so that they're killed." So Glooskap, because he was a god, he caused himself to grow taller. And then he touched a squirrel on the head. And the squirrel started to become tinier and tinier. And he knew that he was becoming tiny, but he couldn't stop himself. And so the squirrel became smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. And finally, Glooskap just picked him up in his hand. He said, "Now, what will you do when you see the people?" He said, "Well, I won't be able to do anything. I'm so small. But I should want to live where they can't find me." So he said, "Very well, squirrel. Your home shall be in the trees, and you shall make your house out of many different types of leaves." So the squirrel scampered off. And then Glooskap took his bow and arrow, which was magic, and he shot it at a willow tree and split the tree, and from out of the center stepped a young man. And then he took another arrow, split another tree, and from out of that tree stepped a young woman. And then he split all the trees until children and everyone came out of the trees. And then he called the people and the animals to live together, to come together, and told them that they must learn to live together in peace, and that the men were only to hunt for food. The animals would understand this. But the people, and in those days, the animals and the people could communicate. They could all speak the same language. This is what they say. So the animals went their way and the people went their way. But the people didn't do as they were told. People were stingy. They wouldn't help older people. And they were selfish. And the hunters just shot animals just for sport. And the animals also quarreled among each other. And so Glooskap called them all together once more. And he said, "I've watched you, and I created all of you, and you haven't done what I've asked you to do. Therefore, I am going away, and I'm going to leave this land, and I will only come back when you learn to live as brothers." And so he turned and walked away into the sunset. And when the animals and people turned to talk to each other to say how sorry they were, when the wolf wanted to say he was sorry and he would do better, the only sound that came from him was "woo." And when the coyote wanted to say he was sorry, "woo." And the crow wanted to say he was sorry, and from that day to this day, people and the animals have never trusted each other because they can't speak to each other. That's the story.
We've been very, very excited, and let's calm down now as we go back to our classrooms and do our work. Now, as I'm talking, let us go quietly back to our work. Very happy that we've had this wonderful morning.
We also have, I was going to run a, I thought that's what a workshop was. I'd get you all in line and run a relay. There isn't room here now.
You need it.
Maybe we, if it's worthwhile, we'll do it next another time.
Yes, I think that we ought to.
Do it today?
Not necessarily today, but at certain point we will want to.
All right, fine. The only other thing that I can think of is that we'd like to have the touch-off take place with the person who is waiting to have his arm out to the side rather than straight on, because we found out that the chance for accidents there too, particularly when they get older and they run fast.
How do you mean that, Harry?
Well, if I'm waiting for you to come back and touch me off, if you run right by me and touch my hand here, you see you're not so apt to run into me and slow me down for one thing, and also you might sting my hand a little bit, but you're not going to come into me this way, you see.
I see.
Games involving a wall, there's a little difference there, but when there's just a plain touch off. We also say that if you put one foot on or across that turning line, that's sufficient. Because that helps in the coordination of kids learning to go down there, do a sharp stop and start back. Just another skill. Can anyone think of anything else, or do you want to
do you do any, I know this has come up by a lot of parents lately since Kennedy came out with his physical fitness deal.
I'm glad you raised that. Go ahead.
Well, do you up there, as a part of your business program at Warren, do you do a lot of calisthenics, or do you confine most of your phys ed to, skills and sports? And
we have, now we could be wrong about this, but we do not use calisthenics as such in a program of developmental way. We use calisthenics as warm-ups, and are using it toward the end goal in the sports area that we're trying to work toward. There have been some very excellent programs built on rhythms, and Bonnie Pruden, for instance, is one adherent to that. There's a man up the 92nd Street Y now that has, he calls it a Slimnastics program, but actually what it is controlled calisthenics to music. This type of thing has very many attributes. We do not do very much of it. 2 years ago, I did quite a bit with it because there was a felt need. At that time, we had a group of boys who were tremendously overweight, and we were trying to sell them on a bodybuilding. Now, we have peculiar limitations up there. When we go out to the park, all I insist on, and this is a good point, I insist that they wear sneakers from a safety standpoint. But that's the only gymnasium outfit that they have, is their sneakers. So I don't believe that I would want to go into a bodybuilding program there. Personally, and the school seems to agree that the outdoor activity is very important. Now, collegiate school comes out with all their students dressed in gray sweatsuits, and under that they have a regulation gym uniform. They have the locker facilities and shower facilities and the time to do all that. I think that is a very good program. But when we go indoors, now this group 2 years ago, we had them dress. It was tough because we have no place to store suits. The dressing facilities were very, very limited. It was a good experience for them because there were impinging interests. The girls always seemed, the boys were sure, the girls were just on the other side of the door all the time.
What about, I think you mentioned something about a program of self-measurement.
Self-testing.
Yeah.
Some years ago, I adopted for my own use this California, some of these people that are involved in the writing of this syllabus also came out with these self-testing stunts. I think you could do it without being technically prepared as I was by just reading up on it. I'd be glad to help anybody if they wanted to do it. I had my first one this year. It was an indoor one where they just shoot baskets for 1 minute, for instance.
The Bonnie Pruden's physical fitness program, there is involved is self-testing, all kinds of tests for the development of the muscles of the body, and so that each individual seeks self-improvement, tries to improve their record on these things. Mm-hmm. I think the idea is a good one, and maybe there could be some adaptation of that.
You could adapt as a school, for instance, some kind of a program, a simple one, say of a pentathlon, where you could measure the progress of the kids at a certain grade level once a year against a standardized thing throughout the eighth grade, and keep a cumulative record card on him. I was going to refer, as it was brought to mind a little while back, but how many of you are familiar with the Krauss-Weber tests? Have you heard of those? Krauss and Weber are medical people, and they have a, Bonnie Pruden refers to it too.
Yeah.
They have a simple test that was given on an international basis. I don't think it was given scientifically to large numbers. I think it was more on a sampling basis, but I'm not sure about that. But there was a lot of publicity about it, in that the American children had, for instance, weak abdominal muscles. See, the Krauss-Weber test asked for the kids to assume a supine position on the floor, and a hook lying position, that is, with the knees bent up. And I've forgotten exactly how it was, but I think the hands were in back, and they had to do sit-ups. Well, the American child turned out to be inferior as far as abdominal strength is concerned in comparison with the British child. We did it at Walden, and we disproved the Krauss-Weber. Our kids didn't seem to have much difficulty. They
Was
weren't.
This after practice or
well,
without
no.
practice?
This was without practice. Okay. But maybe our testing technique wasn't. Anyway, the kids felt very proud. On the other hand, when they try these California things, it's marked on a basis of 0 to 100.
What are some of the other things you mentioned? The
basketball
throw.
Well, in
jumps,
California,
like that?
Well, they
jumping.
Do sit-ups, they do push-ups, they do rope climb. And they have it all worked out. You have to take the grade, classify the child first, and they're classified according to age, weight, and height. The age goes down to months and a year. And then they're given a component for each of those. Then the addition of the components is put on a scale that puts them either in A. A would be very, very strong, older kids. That would be the top class, you see. And in the top class, they have to, say, run 100 in close to 10 seconds in order to get 100 points.
I remember when I was in high school, we went to the same line.
Yes, in New York City, they have their own system.
They still do it?
Yes, they still do it.
I think that's a good idea.
We might search around and try to find something that would be applicable.
To just touch on this problem of the exceptionally able child. Who's far ahead of anybody else in the group.
But you're the famous father.
Well, the father is too.
I have read that with
Well, I have felt that the child was particularly unhappy about it, but the father feels that just as an academic ability we provide for that child, we should in physical ability, so that there's more challenge.
Well, you know,
this boy is a very able boy.
If the father is posing this problem on the basis of surrounding this child with highly skilled children in order to give him feeling of equal competition. I don't think he could attain it, you see.
I don't think that's what he's saying here. I think he's saying that the that we have to consider more seriously our physical education program and make it generally more challenging. Therefore, it'll be
well,
more challenging.
Well, he was thinking of his...
To the more, yes, he was definitely thinking to the whole son.
All right, now, you see, I was going to say...
The program is geared, the rest of the children couldn't take anything more.
Well, I was going to say, in a self-testing program, the sky's the limit, you see.
Yes, that
and this kid would get great satisfaction.
For instance, we do a, with the rope, we do what we used to call low water, high water.
Yes,
and
yeah.
And he is just fantastic.
But there's, you know, this broad jump in this California thing. I don't even know, I think.
Well, our time is up.
Just while we're on this, because we probably never come back to it, the question of a girl in the eighth grade, in basketball, for instance, the seventh and eighth grade girls play together, and this girl is, well, she's as good as any of the boys. She's just terrific. Well, there isn't any, there's very little challenge, and when she comes down the court with the basketball, the kids just all get out of the way. That's
why can't you play with the balls?
Why can't
they're swimming. it, you know, now in baseball, you see, the difference isn't so obvious. But on this in this basketball situation, it is a problem.
Well, you have to go play against it.
No, I have bigger and good. And I tried matching against kids almost his size, and the other day I matched him against a real little guy, but it was fast. They were playing line soccer, just drilled him in the middle. And I just didn't know what was going to happen, but the little guy was awful sharp. Instead of trying to pull it out, he stood back and waited for the first move and made the score. I think you can, if you can figure out what girl can do it, someone can take that ball. I really think so.
Not only that.
Kids, they're afraid of her because she's so fast.
Not only that, but you can teach two kids to play her.
Yeah.
One to challenge her and one to wait. You see, that's the strategy you use in varsity. When you put two on the very best one. And hope that they don't find out that you're short one.
Judo.
I said that. Didn't hear me. You can shift that girl.
Yes, you were talking about putting handicaps. Well, this has been very, very helpful, and we look forward to more.
Thanks. When will the next one be?
I think that one of the most important things that it does is to share the honors around. And I think we every now and then have to look at our teaching and to see how often we call on the same people and how often we ask the very efficient little girl to be the secretary or the chairman or something like that. And we build a sort of a hierarchy in the class. These are the ones that get called on to do the jobs. And this kind of thing automatically sees to it that things are passed around. Bob was telling about how two children who were new in the school were captains. And I think that this, normally this kind of thing might never happen to two new girls in the group, and certainly wouldn't happen for a long time. And I think this is a very important aspect of it.
Norman, keeping the same thing in mind, I've taken the same system, and each week I have a class leader, which is that child's job to pass out the papers, to collect homework, doing odds and ends, also strictly alphabetical. Mm-hmm. They're on for a week, and then the next person.
Anything further before we go on? Okay, Harry.
I use the relay races this week, a little more than I had been. With the running to a certain point and then return, I had used a different type where I had the groups divided in half one side and half the other. But I was impressed by your point about learning this turn.
We did something
and away from a wall and or a fence.
We in first grade, of course, we're still learning just techniques of how to play games, how to have tag and so on. But our favorite game at this point is 3D, and which we've really mastered how to get run in front of the person where you want to stop and not cut in, and how to go around the circle not more than once. But we've done something that I would like to ask about, unless you're going to get into it later, is some of the skills. What happens if you jump the gun on skills for an age group? For psychological reasons, and let me be specific, the first grade boys and a few girls, and many of the second grade boys and a few girls, have been joining in with this playground director over the playground where we go, and teaching them first how to throw a football, because one of the children brought a football, and then the next day how to catch. And the children just loved this, and it was very good, I think. It's good for them psychologically, and it's also a nice controlled situation, and they had recognized each other's abilities, and they had a chance to prove their own ability to throw and catching. And his name is John, the attendant. He commented after our second session on how amazed he was at the quick grasp of these children in these techniques. And I wanted to check with you whether we should go on a little more than just passive throwing and catching. Is this all, if you think it's all right to go on to a little more, you know, the kicking and then maybe some of the touch football?
You know, that's an interesting point. I'm all in favor of, if I understand it correctly, what's happening there, except with my technical background, I would examine it and try to steer it into something that I think has a little more advantage. A person, you see, I'd wonder if the fellow over there, he must have a desire, and he is relating well to the kids, and the kids are relating well to him.
Very well.
Now, I would wonder if he were a trained enough person to recognize the fact that there are going to be a few outstanding kids in that group who are going to make quick progress And if he's going to be aware of those who are not catching on, and if he's going to bring them along too. Now, he could be doing this, but I would just look out for that. Then the other thing that I would examine in this whole approach on a specific basis is the use of the football. See? Now, football is seasonal, and I suppose it's motivated by a few boys, particularly the boy that brought it.
And the need to use it.
Yeah, and his need to use it. But you see, then I'm trying to relate
and the parents need to give it to him.
Yes. But I'm relating the whole thing to the growth of the whole group, you see. Now, I would say that the skill in handling a football is a unique one, and it is limited to just that one activity, that sport. But when you get into the handling, catching and throwing the ball, it's usually associated with a different shape of the round one. Now, the size is adjustable, see, according to the age. But the throwing and catching of a round ball is a much more valuable skill, and I would say that maybe moving from the football, because the interest is aroused, to a ball that more resembles a basketball, for instance, or a softball, would have a much greater, would meet a greater need, I think, on the overall physical development. I know of one administrator who his first evaluation of a whole physical education program is, can every person throw and catch a ball? You see, if anybody in our society that can't throw and catch a ball is at a disadvantage one way or another, as far as group is concerned.
Harris, I was curious on if you felt was doing harm. Now, I work with him. I mean, it's not as though the children are left alone with him, firstly. And secondly, I think one of the reasons these kids were so good at done a lot of practicing of throwing overhand and underhand with a round ball and small, they loved it. And they had, they really developing this skill.
What skill is that
of
passing?
The throwing and catching, passing,
No, I mean passing a football. What are they going
to
do?
No, I didn't mean that, Norman. We've been doing
it. No, but my question is, maybe I'm sort of not following what you're saying, but I was wondering where you're going with this skill.
With football?
Yeah.
That's why I'm raising it. Because I didn't know how far we should go, whether we should go into this game. Some of these kids need a good workout, we felt. And this was something that came.
But suppose you develop them away from the rest of the group, what's going to happen? You're going to make them just unhappy and feeling that the rest of the group is baby stuff? That's a question, too.
Well, this comes during their free time, interestingly enough. First, they have organized games. Second grade does. First grade does. They have organized games at their level.
I think we ought to approach this from another point of view, start the systematic discussion of what's appropriate to the different. Wasn't that what you were going to do?
Yeah, we were going to hit that now. These skills might come up in our discussion. Before I get into that, Norman, we spoke at the tail end of the meeting last session on some kind of a testing program. Now, I have here what I think would be just about the ideal for the school here, if you want it out. It's simple. It's sponsored by the technical organization I should belong to, the American Association for Health, Physical Education, and Recreation. And this pamphlet could be obtained quite easily. The address is in Washington, D.C. It's the Youth Fitness Test Manual. They set up seven different activities that can be tested. And they give you the administration for it, the directions. And the ages are from 5 years to 12. Now, I don't know that that covers our first grade through our eighth, does it?
Yeah. It wouldn't cover the eighth, but it'd cover the seventh.
Okay. I think that you'll find that the norms are kind of high, so even the eighth grade might be interested in it. Now, supposing we stay on this for a few minutes and see whether you would be interested in it. There's a pull-up for boys, and there's a modified pull-up for girls. The equipment is simple, a ladder or a bar. Sit-up, no equipment necessary.
Which, this is right foot?
This is boys and girls.
Right foot.
Grade, oh, I'm sorry, did I say age? No, this is grades 5 to 12, sorry.
Hmm? So that's through high school.
Yeah. It starts with the fifth and it'll go through the eighth. I'll tell you in a moment where I got the ages mixed in there. So we wouldn't have a testing program for the first, second, third, and fourth on this basis. Shuttle run, which is like a potato race, a little different setup. Standing broad jump, 50-yard dash, a softball throw for distance, and then a 600-yard combination run and walk. And those are all for boys and girls from the 5th through the 12th grade. There's also an aquatic test that you might be interested for your older groups that are going over to the pool. Now, this is a national thing. There are two ways to classify your students. One is the one that I mentioned last time on getting exponents for age, height, and weight, and then adding them and then putting them up against a scale and getting a classification of A, B, C, D, and so on.
Detached, and after weight, goes back on. Now, I was told by a Civil War soldier that was in the latter part of the war, when the first repeating British loading rifles came into the hands of Union troops,